The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here again to tackle some really monumental works of thought, break them down, and pull out the insights you really need. Today, we are getting into a text that, honestly, it's not an exaggeration to say it gave us the blueprint for the modern mind. John Locke's 1689 masterpiece, An Essay Concerning Human Understanding.
Yeah, and it's so much more than just, you know, a dusty old philosophy book. It's this huge undertaking. Locke was really setting out to map the entire landscape of human knowledge, where it comes from, what it is, and maybe most importantly, what its limits are. The big question he makes us wrestle with is, how do we actually get knowledge, and what can our minds realistically, reliably understand?
Right, and why should you, listening now, care about a book from, what, over 300 years ago? Well, because it was like intellectual dynamite. It systematically challenged centuries of accepted beliefs, of dogma. Mm-hmm. By arguing knowledge comes from experience, not from being born with it, Locke laid the groundwork for modern science, for psychology, even for liberal political ideas. It really promoted tolerance and reason over just accepting things blindly. It's basically the user manual for thinking critically.
Okay, let's zoom in on the man himself then. John Locke, 1632 to 1704. He wasn't just a philosopher pondering things in isolation, was he? What was his background like? How did that shape this very observational, almost scientific way he approached the mind?
That's a great point. He was genuinely interdisciplinary. He actually trained as a physician at Oxford, and he was right in the thick of the scientific revolution. Think people like Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton. They were his contemporaries. So his interest wasn't just abstract philosophy. It was natural philosophy. He wanted to understand how the mind actually works, almost like studying a patient.
Ah, so bringing that empirical method observation, looking at the evidence right into philosophy itself.
Exactly. And then you add his deep political involvement. He was an advisor to the Earl of Shaftesbury, a really powerful figure. He lived through some incredibly turbulent times in 17th century England, political chaos, instability. He saw firsthand why people clung so tightly to beliefs they hadn't really examined. And that kind of fueled his mission. The idea was, maybe if we could figure out a rational, experience-based way to know things, we could achieve more stability, both politically and intellectually.
Okay, so step one is clearing away the old ideas. And Locke's big opening move is revolutionary, rejecting innate ideas. The mind starts as a blank slate.
That's the famous tabula rasa, yeah? White paper. Locke insisted the mind at birth is void of all characters. Just blank. If we're not born knowing about God or moral rules or even basic logic, then, well, where does all our knowledge come from?
And his answer, the big answer, is experience. Just one word. But he breaks that down, right? Into two main channels.
That's right. Two sources. First is sensation. That's all the raw data coming in from the outside world through our senses. You know, seeing colors, feeling textures, hearing sounds. Input. The second source is reflection. This is internal. It's the mind observing its own operations, thinking, doubting, believing, willing. Introspection, basically. All knowledge, every single idea, is built up from those two fundamental types of experience. Nothing else.
And this isn't just a theory he throws out there. It's a whole project. He actually says his goal is to clear the ground a little and remove some of the rubbish. Huh. So Book High of the Essay is all about demolition, taking down that idea of innate knowledge.
Exactly. It's the negative part of his project. And he's incredibly thorough. He goes after innate speculative principles, things like logical rules, what is, and also innate practical or moral principles, ideas about right and wrong. His main weapon is observation. He says, look, if these ideas were truly innate, everyone would consciously know them, universally.
But what about those things people say everyone agrees on, like, you know, murder is wrong or basic logic? Doesn't that suggest it's built in?
Locke has a counter for that. Mm-hmm. He says, well, first, universal agreement doesn't automatically prove innateness. It could just come from universal human experience or basic reasoning everyone learns. But more powerfully, he points to children and individuals with significant cognitive impairments. He argues they clearly don't demonstrate knowledge of these supposedly innate principles until they are taught them or figure them out through experience. His challenge is basically, show me the evidence they're born with it, otherwise admit it's learned.
Okay, so Book I clears the slate. Then in Book II, he starts building things back up, the positive project. If the mind starts blank, does it just passively record things, like a camera?
No, far from it. This is where you see the mind as an active workshop. It's not passive at all. We do passively receive what he calls simple ideas. These are like the basic building blocks, the atoms of thought, a specific shade of red, a particular feeling of warmth, a single note. But then the mind gets active. It takes these simple ideas and starts constructing complex ideas. How? By combining them, comparing them, abstracting them. That's how we get ideas like apple, combining redness, roundness, sweetness, or even abstract concepts like justice or gratitude.
And this is where that really famous distinction comes in, the one that helps us understand how we perceive reality. Primary versus secondary qualities. Why is this such a big deal?
It's huge because it fundamentally shifts where we locate certain aspects of reality. Primary qualities are characteristics that are inherent in the object itself. They're inseparable from it, whether we perceive them or not. Think size, shape, motion, solidity, number. These qualities in the object actually resemble our ideas of them.
Okay, so the object really is round or really is moving. And secondary qualities.
Those are different. They aren't in the object itself. They are just the power that the object's primary qualities have to produce certain sensations in us. So a leaf isn't inherently green. Its physical structure, its primary qualities, has the power, when interacting with light in our eyes, to cause the sensation of green in our minds.
Wow. So the shape is real out there, but the green is kind of like a filter applied by our perception. That feels very modern. Like the colors on my screen aren't in the screen. They're just the screen's power to make me see color. That's a big shift.
It really is. And before we leave book two, we absolutely have to mention his idea of identity. It was revolutionary. Locke basically redefined personal identity. He moved it away from being tied to some unchanging soul substance or even the physical body. He argued that what makes you you over time is the continuity of consciousness and memory.
So identity is psychological. It's about awareness and remembering being aware. That's the Prince and the Cobbler thought experiment, isn't it?
Exactly that one. If you could swap the consciousness and memories of a prince into the body of a cobbler, and vice versa, who is who? Locke says the person with the prince's consciousness is the prince, regardless of the body. Identity follows the continuous stream of awareness and memory that links your past self to your present self.
Okay, so the mind builds up all these complex ideas in book two, but then we need to share them. What's the biggest hurdle there? Is that book three about language?
That's precisely it. Book three tackles language. It's our main tool for communication, but as Locke points out, it's also often a trap. His key insight is that words are arbitrary signs. They stand for the ideas inside our heads, not directly for things out there in the world. And that's crucial because if you and I use the same word, say freedom, but we attach different ideas to it, well, we're not really communicating, are we?
Right. And most of our words aren't for specific things like this particular chair. They're general terms, chair, dog, justice. How do we even form those general ideas?
Through a mental process Locke calls abstraction. Our minds observe lots of individual dogs, for example. Then we ignore the differences. This one's big, that one's small, and focus only on the common features to form a general idea or concept of dog. This general definition, based on observable features, is what Locke calls the nominal essence. It's like the dictionary definition we agree on. But, and this is a big but, he warns that we usually can't know the real essence. That's the underlying atomic or physical structure that makes a thing what it truly is.
Okay, so the nominal essence is the shared concept, like gold is a yellow heavy metal. But the real essence is the actual atomic structure, O79. And Locke's saying we usually only grasp the nominal.
Pretty much. We operate with nominal essences. And that distinction is incredibly useful because if Locke saw it, it explains why so many arguments, especially in philosophy or politics, just go round and round. He suspected many disagreements are actually just verbal disputes. We're using the same words, but unknowingly referring to different underlying ideas, different nominal essences. If we just defined our terms clearly up front,
we might find we actually agree, or at least understand why we disagree. That makes sense. Okay, this brings us to book four, the grand finale on knowledge itself, certainty, and its limits. What's Locke's strict definition of knowledge?
For Locke, knowledge is quite specific.
Mm-hmm.
It's the perception of the agreement or disagreement between our ideas. That's it. Can we see a connection or lack of connection between two ideas in our mind? And he lays out degrees of certainty for this perception. The highest level is intuitive knowledge. This is immediate, direct, irresistible certainty, like knowing that white is not black, or that a circle is not a triangle, or even that I exist right now, you just see it. No proof needed.
Okay, top tier. Then what's next? Demonstrative knowledge.
Yes. This is certainty that you reach through logical steps, like links in a chain where each individual link is intuitive. Think of mathematical proofs like in geometry. You start with axioms you know intuitively and reason step by step to a conclusion. It's certain, but it requires mental effort, reasoning.
Right. And the last type, the one we probably use most often in daily life, sensitive knowledge.
That's our knowledge of the existence of particular external objects that are currently affecting our senses. I have sensitive knowledge that this desk exists right now because I can see it and touch it. But crucially, this knowledge only extends as far as my current sensation. I don't have certain knowledge it will be here when I turn away. It's highly probable, but not intuitive or demonstrative.
So the big takeaway from book four seems kind of sobering. Our certain knowledge is actually quite limited. We can't know the real essence of things. Even intuitive and demonstrative knowledge have their bounds. How radical was it then for him to say, okay, since certainty is rare, we have to base most of our life, our practical beliefs, on probability?
Oh, it was absolutely revolutionary. He essentially shifted our core intellectual responsibility. It's not always about achieving absolute certainty, because often we can't. Instead, the moral duty becomes to responsibly weigh the evidence for things we can't be certain about. We have to make judgments constantly without full knowledge. So Locke says we have an obligation to proportion our level of belief to the strength of the evidence available. He called this judgment or opinion. It's a practical guide for navigating uncertainty.
Okay, let's distill this down. What are the key themes or messages for you, the listener, to take away from this massive mapping of the mind? First has to be empiricism itself.
Definitely. The core idea that all knowledge ultimately traces back to experience. This makes Locke the philosophical bedrock for the scientific method. It empowers us to ask of any claim, what's the experiential evidence? Challenge authority, challenge tradition.
And linked to that is the second big theme, intellectual humility.
Yeah, because if our certain knowledge is limited, and we can't know the deep reality, the real essence of things, we have to avoid being dogmatic. We just don't know enough to be absolutely certain about most complex matters, and this naturally leads towards tolerance, right? If my understanding is shaped and limited by my experiences, I need to be open to the fact that someone with different experiences might have different, equally valid perspectives.
I also find his emphasis on the active mind really important. It's not just about receiving data.
Right. It's empowering. The mind isn't just a passive recipient like a bucket being filled. It's an active workshop. It combines, compares, abstracts. It constructs our complex understanding of the world. This means education, providing rich experiences, teaching critical thinking skills. These are vital, because they literally help build the structure of our knowledge.
And finally, that theme of responsibility for belief. He really puts the onus on the individual.
Absolutely. He argues we have kind of moral duty to base our beliefs on evidence and reason as best we can, not just on gut feelings or because someone told us so or tradition. Understanding how we know things makes us responsible for checking the foundations of our own beliefs constantly.
There are some lines in the essay that just capture these ideas so well. Let's touch on a few memorable ones, starting with the core metaphor.
Right. He poses the question. Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper. Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge? To this I answer, in one word, from experience. It just sets the stage perfectly.
And that implies limits, which he states so clearly elsewhere. No man's knowledge here can go beyond his experience. It's both a boundary and a starting point.
And on identity, that crucial psychological definition. In this alone consists personal identity, i.e. the sameness of a rational being, which he clarifies means the continuity of consciousness. It makes the self something internal, remembered, conscious.
And I love his own description of his method. I pretend not to teach, but to inquire. It shows that spirit of collaborative investigation, not just laying down the law.
Exactly. And we can actually put these inquiries, these ideas, into practice in our lives today, can't we?
Yeah, how so? Where does Locke meet the real world now?
Well, think about education and parenting. If the mind starts as a blank slate, tabula rasa, then the focus shifts entirely. It becomes about providing rich, positive, stimulating experiences. And maybe even more importantly, teaching kids how to think, how to combine ideas, how to reason critically, rather than just drilling facts or doctrines into them.
That makes sense. What else?
Communication. Using the lessons from Book 3 on language. When you hit a wall in a discussion, personally or professionally, pause. Instead of repeating the same word louder, ask, okay, wait, what specific idea do you connect with that term? You might find the whole argument was just a verbal dispute based on different definitions.
That could save a lot of headaches. And in today's world, with information coming at us constantly.
Exactly. His framework for critical thinking, proportioning belief to evidence, relying on probability when certainty isn't possible, is more relevant than ever. It's about constantly asking, okay, what's the experiential basis for this claim? Is the evidence strong enough for me to believe this? Question authority, question headlines, look for the grounding in experience.
It's that constant check. Does my level of belief match the level of evidence?
Precisely. It's about managing our own minds responsibly.
You know, what really struck me going through this again is how much of Locke's core thinking, this insistence on evidence, proportioning belief, feels like. Yeah, common sense now. We kind of take for granted the intellectual tools he had to argue so forcefully for against centuries of very different assumptions. The groundwork he laid is just part of how we think now, often without realizing it.
That's a great point. And for me, what I really love is that ultimate message of intellectual self-management. Locke gives us, in a way, a manual for rational living. He urges us to be honest about the limits of our certainty, but still trust our reason and the evidence of our senses to navigate the world. That careful analysis of how we think actually helps us improve how we live. It's profound, really.
So Locke really pushes us to see that our own view of the world is inevitably shaped and limited by our unique path of experiences. The final thought for you, the listener, is this. How does truly recognizing the contingency of your own beliefs, the way they depend on your specific life experiences, change how you interact with other people, especially those whose experiences and therefore beliefs might be vastly different from yours?
Something to definitely think about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.